Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. We are broadcasting from Bristol City Centre, we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello also to our listeners in Preston, St Albans and all around the world via the internets. Our guest this week, Mohamed El Haddad, he is a resident of Bristol who will be talking about the troubles in Libya. We also have Julian Parry with his view of the world this week.
We have features from Anthea Page, who is at the Writers' Museum in Edinburgh, and also from Tony Gosling, who will be asking how the Romans solved their financial crisis and also talking about the privatisation of commons. We have Alec Milne, who will be reading the seventh part of Selected Letters by Robert Louis Stevenson. Trevor Carter is here to read us some of his poetry. And Jeff Sparks is also here with his What's On Guide and Song of the Week. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Hello. Well, complete with resplendent and excellent orchestral stab, here is Julian Parry with The World This Week.
Well, hello. This week I want to talk about social stress. The news last week was dominated by the Middle East. Uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Algeria, and now Libya, where the civil war seems likely to run and run. The question is, why did this happen? The reply came from so many voices. We want jobs, food, fairness, and an end to corruption. And that got me thinking about the UK and the social stresses building here. When you look closely at the issue here at home, we see the telltale signs of similar major stress. We're just not quite as far down the road. With food prices rising, increasing numbers of old people on very low fixed incomes, and more MPs going to jail for fiddling the books, I could not help but get the sense that we have the same problems as the Middle East, perhaps to a lesser degree. With the coalition government pronouncing that a life on benefits is no longer an option, jobs has to be the focus of immediate attention, which is a worry as it seems the situation could become catastrophic in the not-too-distant future. According to David Blanchflower, member of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, employment is becoming a really important issue. In a recent interview, he points out that during the last quarter of 2010, unemployment rose to 2.5 million, and it's getting worse, even though none of the public sector cuts have come through yet. Most of these will come next year from local government. The local government sector is far larger than the central government, which employs a mere 527,484 people at the last count. That's the membership of the civil service. There are also glaring disparities in the proportions of particular jobs between the two. Official figures reveal that under Blair and Brown, New Labour allowed town hall jobs to hit nearly 3 million amid a shocking explosion in non-jobs. The recruitment bonanza saw local authorities keep on hiring even through the recession. Further figures show that almost 750,000 council workers, one in four, is not employed to deliver a frontline service, such as roles in education, social services, or even bin collections. And let's face it, most bin collections are carried out by contractors, not by directly employed staff. Thousands of local councillors at the same time have seen their allowances soar in the past 5 years. The town hall payouts have risen by 150% in that time to a total cost of more than £200 million a year. Six-figure salaries have become more and more common. Some 1,250 town hall staff earned more than £100,000 in 2008-09 and £25,000 across the public sector. There is a chief executive officer who has just left Dorset Council. He was earning huge money. Phil Dolan received £569,000 of taxpayers' money in salary, pensions and redundancy payments after leaving his post as chief executive of South Somerset District Council. He is now acting as a consultant for other local authorities. Two other executives at the tiny council also received more than £300,000 each in salary, pensions and severance payments last year. Makes you wonder how the poor people of South Somerset can afford it. But let's face it, they have no choice. These statistics will intensify anger over spending cuts at local authorities. Many warn that they are being forced to close libraries, swimming pools and leisure centres to save money. More locally to Bristol, where we are tonight, the Bristol Evening Post recently produced banner headlines announcing council bosses can earn more than the PM. David Cameron, with a UK population of 62 million to look after, receives a salary of £140,000 after agreeing a pay cut of 5%. Baines, that's Bath and North East Somerset, population approximately 240,000. The CEO, Mr. John Everett, is earning around £170,000 a year. South Gloucestershire, approximately 225,000 people. CEO, Mrs. Amanda Deeks, comes third at 158,000. City of Bristol and South Gloucestershire say, in short, we have to attract and retain the best with competitive salaries. South Gloucestershire also say the CEO is thinking of taking a 5% cut in salary. Well, that's darn decent of him, isn't it? Just thinking about it, I mean. Meanwhile, in North Somerset, my favourite place, CEO Graham Turner is said to earn between £129,000 and £144,000 a year. Well, that's rather a lot of money for him. Meanwhile, nationally, employment was down 68,000, but the employment of young persons was down 113,000. Now there are 965,000 young people between the ages of 16 and 24 out of work. And this is at a time when George Osborne and David Cameron are saying that life on benefits is no longer an option. The young unemployed need new jobs. The question is, where are they coming from? The private sector is the only place that they can be found, and they need to take up the slack, but there's no evidence of that happening. Nor will it happen until a whole raft of employment regulations designed to buy politicians' votes at the expense of the business community have finally been demolished. Private sector jobs were up only 8,000 in the last quarter. We need another 2.5 million over the next 4 years. Otherwise, David Blanchflower says, it looks as if the economy could go belly up. And from there, all sorts of social stresses can emerge.
Julian Parry, thank you very much once again.
Malcolm Grieve is soon to be reading that well-known favourite set in Bristol, Treasure Island, as part of the show's ongoing serial. But as a run-up to this dramatic event, Alec Milne has been reading the letters of the author Robert Louis Stevenson, as you may have been hearing, and our dialect reporter Anthea Page visited the Writers' Museum in Edinburgh to bring us the report about memorabilia housed inside the museum, and she'll also have details about the life of Robert Louis Stevenson from the Robert Louis Stevenson Society.
Museum just off the High Street in Edinburgh, and I'm downstairs in the basement, and we're looking at a photograph of Robert Louis Stevenson, and one of the volunteers here is a member of the Robert Stevenson Society. What's your name?
Barbara McCudden.
Now, you went on a visit to Bristol last year because of the connection with Treasure Island.
That's right, yes. We were entertained royally by Mark Steed. He's in charge of the Stevenson Trail that is hopefully going to be made along the harbour side. Do you know about that, with all the statues of Treasure Island characters?
Could you just give us a brief synopsis of Stevenson's life?
Yeah, well, he was born here in Edinburgh in 1850. He was very sickly, and he went to university and took a degree in engineering, which his father wanted him to do because they were the Stevenson Lighthouse people. They built all the lighthouses around Scotland, and his father wanted him to follow in his footsteps, but he didn't like that, so he took another. He sat again, graduated as a lawyer, an advocate, and he became an advocate, but he didn't get any work because he wasn't interested. He wanted to write, and he started writing when he was quite young, and then he went to France. He used to go to France a lot for his health, and he met Fanny Stevenson, who was there on a painting holiday. She was married with two children, fell in love, and she went back to America and eventually achieved a divorce from her husband. And he went over there, and they married, and came back here, but every time he came home, of course, he was ill.
What was he suffering from?
It was chest problems he had, lung problem. It was a weakness. His mother suffered from weak lungs as well. It was supposed to be tuberculosis, but there is a more detailed medical name for it, you know, what he had. But anyway, he started sailing and had an interest in the South Seas. So he started going to all the South Sea Islands and decided that Samoa was the place he wanted to end his days, or not end his days, but settle. And he built his home there and was there for his last 4 years of his life. And he died of a brain hemorrhage.
How old was he when he died?
44.
So quite young then?
Very young, yes.
Did he ever visit Bristol?
Yes, yes he did, because there's a Hole in the Wall pub. That is supposed to be the Long John Silver's pub in the story Treasure Island. So he had all the knowledge of Bristol. But he was in most places in the UK. A great traveller.
There's a beautiful drawing here. How old was he in this one? it's a photograph.
It's a photograph, yes. He was 26 when he canoed with a friend, Walter Simpson, up the canals of Belgium and France. And that is something else that the club are hoping to do next year, is to do that same journey.
You were talking earlier about California, trying to find the connection and his letters.
Yes, well, he went to Monterey when he followed Fanny to wait for her getting her divorce so they could marry. And he stayed in Monterey. What was it called? I can't remember the name of the hotel that he stayed in. Simon's Hotel, I think. Stayed there, and then he went to San Francisco, where Fanny lived in Oakland. But he became very ill and he had the first of his hemorrhages. He used to have terrible lung hemorrhages. And she nursed him, and then the divorce came through and they got married in San Francisco in 1883. And that was when Treasure Island was published, and that's when he started to earn. Up till then, his father had more or less kept him.
So did he publish Treasure Island in America?
Well, no, I think it would be published in Britain.
Did he have any children himself?
No, only his two stepchildren.
What other photos have we got here? Which are the latest ones? This one, was it? This one before he died? 1885.
No, there's none. They're through here. They're in the other room, actually.
So we're just going through to another room. There's all the memorabilia associated with Stevenson in this room. I think we've got a pair of his boots here. Is that his boots?
Yes.
He had very big feet. Yes. Well, lots of photographs here. This is a nice one. Where was that?
That was the house he built in Samoa.
Is that still there?
Yes, yes, I was there 2 or 3 years ago. Yes.
This is on the desert island?
It's on Samoa, Apia. This is the finished article. This is the house as it was when he died. And this is a photograph of the inside, where their family, they had a little musical corner. They all played some kind of instrument.
Documentary going on in the background, but we're actually standing in front of one of the last photographs of him before he died, and that was taken on in the South Sea Islands.
Yes, yes, yes.
With his, there's sort of natives in the background.
His son, his stepson, Lloyd.
Are you still in touch with any of the children, the stepchildren?
No, they only died in maybe the 50s. It's amazing how recent, you know, it all is. There was people just recently still knew Stevenson, you know, had known him, old ladies and old men who had actually met him, and it's incredible to think he was so recent.
Did you collect any audio of people who knew him?
No, he did do a voice test on one of these little carbon flimsy things, the very first recording machines, you know, but it's not lasted, it's not No, we don't know his voice at all. Everything else we know about him, but we don't know his voice. But he had a nice, educated Edinburgh accent, so we can surmise what it sounded like.
What was his connection with other writers and painters of the times?
Well, he was friends. Barry, J.M. Barrie, and Kipling, and Henry James, and I mean, the list's endless of the people around in that era. No, he was a great writer. There's 8 volumes of his letters been published, which most of us in the club have, and that is fascinating. You know, all the letters he wrote to people and all his correspondence. So that's where his life really lies, in these letters.
So next year you're off to California.
We're off to California again to renew our friendship with the club there. There's a lovely Monterey club. And they are very fortunate. When Stevenson died, Fanny, his widow, went back to America and took all the furniture, which came from Harriet Row in Edinburgh. She took it back to America with her. So they have all the Harriet Row furniture where Stevenson lived here, you know, his parents' furniture. Then we go up to the Napa Valley, where also there's where he spent his honeymoon. And there's a Silverado Museum up there, which has masses of things that, you know, have been sold in America. So they're very, very lucky with all the things they have. We love our collection, but oh, we'd die for what they have.
That was Dialect reporter Anthea Page there, reporting from the Writers' Museum in Edinburgh. And look out for Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve, which will be coming up very soon. And now here is Alec Milne to read the 7th part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest Mayhew. The music is Duff, performed by Concert Caledonia. And following that, the Fanny Stevenson letter is read by Frances Mary.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 7. Ordered South Again, Marseille and Hyères, October 1882 to June 1884. Stevenson left Edinburgh for London on 8 September 1882 and, after consulting Dr. Andrew Clarke, decided to set out for the south of France in search of a suitable place to stay for the winter. Fanny, still in Edinburgh, was too ill to accompany him, so Bob went with him as far as Montpellier, then had to return to England because his wife was ill. RLS decided against Montpellier but moved on to Marseille, where Fanny joined him in mid-October. Here they found the Campagne Defli at Saint-Marcel. RLS loved the house and garden, but it was, in his words, as damp as a sponge and poisonous with marshes. After a short stay in Nice and various misadventures, they at last discovered the chalet La Solitude at the winter health resort of Hyères, 11 miles east of Toulon and 3 miles inland from the Mediterranean, and moved there in March 1883. Fanny described it 20 years later.
A chalet was an incongruous object in Hyères, and it was made more conspicuous by its position, clinging to a low cliff almost at the entrance of the old town. From this cliff, the ground rose with a gentle gradient, and just outside our garden gate, where it became more rugged and steep, breaking out near the summit into rocky crags that were crowned with the ruins of an ancient Saracen castle. Our tiny chalet was the result of a visit of the owner to the Paris Exposition of 1878. There, amidst Chinese pagodas, Turkish mosques and the like in miniature, stood a model Swiss chalet that so fascinated our landlord that he bought it outright and had it removed to be again erected on his property in Hyères. It was like a doll's house, with rooms so small that we could hardly turn round in them. But the view from the verandas was extensive. The garden was large and wild, with winding paths and old grey olive trees where nightingales nested and sang. Looking in one direction, we could see the Île d'Or, and in another, the hills beyond Toulon.
As the letters show, Arwelus delighted in these surroundings and thoroughly enjoyed the pleasure of having a home of his own. It was a prolific time in the way of correspondence, and, as Colvin noted, there is perhaps no period in his life when his letters reflect so fully the variety of his moods and the eagerness of his occupations. Looking back from Samoa in March 1891, Arwelus was to declare, "I was only happy once. That was at Hyères." To his mother, 5th January 1883, Grand Hotel, Nice. "My dear mother, please continue to address me at Saint Marcel so that Fanny may have sight of the letters. But here I am at Nice, Grand Hotel, a little further up the river than the old Chavon, now Cosmopolitan. What a change from 20 years ago. The very river is now bridged over, and the gardens and casinos and the like occupy its place. The old Chavon I looked into. Gone was the garden court. Gone, of course, all the travelling carriages I used to play among with the little Italian girl and the little German boy. Only the Place Messina still has its arcades, and the identical cafe still remains, where I remember seeing my father and Mr. Abbott sitting in the moonlight. Abbott eating ices. And there was still the bastioned fort on the hilltop over the old Menton Road that I adored beyond anything in stone and lime I ever saw. 20 years, dear me, I am an old man for all the good I've done. I think the change has done me a great deal of good, however. This huge caravanserai is fearfully dear, but I am still too weary to look for anything else. I stay mostly in bed, eat and drink of the best I can find, and banish care with all my might. Still, it was a sell to have to leave home, where Sam was there too. I'm sorry my letter to my father went astray. It was engineering in part, and so, let us hope, not valuable. My best wishes to you both, and my best love. Auld Lang Syne is very close to me here. R.L.S." To his parents, 5th of May, 1883. Chalet Solitude. "My dearest people, I have had a great piece of news. There has been offered for Treasure Island. How much do you suppose? I believe it would be an excellent jest to keep the answer till my next letter. For 2 cents I would do so. Shall I? Anyway, I'll turn the page first. No. Well, £100, all alive. Oh, 100 jingling, tingling, golden minted quid. Is not this wonderful? Add that I have now finished, in draft, the 15th chapter of my novel, and I have only 5 before me, and you'll see what cause of gratitude I have. The weather, to look out at the per contra sheet, continues vomitable, and Fanny is quite out of sorts. But really, with such a cause of gladness, I have not the heart to be dispirited by anything. My child's book is finished, dedication and all, and out of my hand. You may tell Cummy, Silverado is done too, and cast upon the waters, and this novel, so near in completion, it does look as if I should support myself without trouble in the future. If I have only health, I can, I thank God. It is dreadful to be a great big man and not be able to buy bread. Oh, that this may not last. I have today paid my rent for the half year, till the middle of September, and got my lease. Why have things been so long? I know not. I wish you all sorts of good things. When is our marriage day? Your loving and ecstatic son, Treasure Island. It has been for me a treasure island, verily.
Sound bites all over the British press for the past week. Bristol-based Libyan Mohamed El Haddad is an old friend of Dialect from around 18 months ago, when he was one of the organisers of the aid convoy which has helped to relieve the Israeli siege of Gaza in occupied Palestine. History is being made right now in the Arab world, but beware of certain opinions and experts reeling out their opinions in the press. If you hear a spokesperson from the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Royal United Services Institute, or some university experts, beware. They may be in the pay of the arms industry, pushing an elite point of view. You can check most of these spokespeople and their organisations out at Strathclyde University's website, www.spinwatch.org. Anyway, less about the propaganda and more from Bristol's Libyan community. Mohamed El Haddad, hello and welcome to Starlix.
Hi, good evening, hi.
So how are your family now? Because I understand you have family in Libya.
Yes, my family in the city of Al Baida, which was the first city where we had these clashes. At the moment, they are okay. I've been in touch with them and through a third party from Tripoli. There is no direct communication between Britain and my city, Al Baida, but a third party in Tripoli managed to contact them, and I managed to contact that third party, so they are safe and secure.
Okay, because you were, I understand you believed for a while that they might possibly have been killed. You weren't sure.
Absolutely, yes. Basically, apparently, we've lost about three of my, extended, members of the family, but they are not from my own family, my father, mother, brother, and sisters, basically.
Right. How difficult, this might be an obvious question given what you said, how difficult was it to really find out what was actually going on?
The most difficult part was there is no media coverage from outsiders, basically organizations or media or other TV channels, internet. There were no way to communicate with proper media channels and find out about the truth. The only way where people managed to get and upload some document, which usually against the government, because the government was not involved in that beginning of the clashes stage.
People are making quite a big deal of people being able to video things, say, on their mobile phones or cameras and upload them onto the internet themselves. Have you watched many videos? Have you found many of these online?
I did, and I watched a lot of them, yes. And apparently I found a lot of people who I knew from my own town on those videos. but there is no way for me to ask them about my family and my, you know, relatives there. But yeah, it was quite difficult for me to follow up all the changes. It was very short time, and incredibly changed all the circumstances and all the situation in that city. And then the East have all together gathered and managed to raise their voices.
Okay, what is the difference really between what is going on in Libya and what is going on in other countries in the Arab world? Because we don't want to make the mistake of blurring all of this into one too much.
There is quite a huge difference between Libya and Tunisia and Egypt, basically. Libya is a quite wealthy country, and whereas Egypt and Tunisia, they're is a lot, a huge number of people who are not able to carry on their life, weekly life, or they have not got the financial ability to sustain or to guarantee their week in terms of food or accommodation or these type of essential things in your life.
Yeah.
But it's not the case in Libya. This is one thing. The other thing is that, culturally, there's quite a big difference, because Libya is a group or a big number of tribals where everybody knows the others. All the Libyan citizens knows each other. And there is a bit of conflict and difference between those tribals in terms of geographical locations, in terms of their wealth, level of economy, and in terms of their relationship with the government, and in terms of their relationship with the Gaddafi himself and his tribal, and that's the difficult side of it. And the good side of it is that those people knows each other, and they visit each other. They have very good strong relationship with each other, which can be marriage, friendship, neighborhood. So they knew each other, and it is easy to send a message through all those people, and it's also easy to unite them against one party or disunited them against one party.
Right.
It's quite easy because of the culture side of it and the connection between those people.
So once one sort of small revolution has started, because of the way everybody connects, it can snowball quite quickly.
Correct.
Okay. Were you actually surprised at what is happening when you first discovered it was starting?
I was surprised, yes, because I did not expect that huge disadvantages respond from the government. The government did not respond to the first protesters from the city of Al-Baydah. They managed to fire three police stations and get all the prisoners out of the, escape them from the prison without any one gun or loss of life at all.
Right.
The government was given a clear instruction and message to the police officers not to engage with the public, so they do not lose any lives. And then they decided basically to go to go further to reach the internal security headquarter, and that's where the life have start losing and we start losing people there when the police officers start shooting citizens.
How have you felt about the media's news coverage of what has been going on, not only British, but also, I suppose, Al Jazeera as well? People might be watching that.
Al Jazeera was misfeeding people all the time from the first day.
Okay.
And it was used by other members where people did not really tell us the truth. For example, yesterday we were told that Tripoli was hit by aircrafts.
Mm-hmm.
Straight away to the ordinary people in the city, from the aircraft to the city. That means Tripoli wouldn't be alive to this morning.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Mean? We were told that a lot of a fleet of, army helicopters and flights.
Yes.
They were shooting ordinary people in the city of Tripoli. And they are straight away. They never stopped. And we received calls on Al Jazeera from people talking on Al Jazeera.
Mm-hmm.
We are under a threat. We cannot secure ourselves. Flights are shooting us. We are now trying to avoid those guns and those snipers from those flights. In fact, you know, we found out this morning, we were absolutely cautious about our friends there. But today, all of those information were false. We were misfed by information from Al Jazeera.
So what was actually going on?
There's nothing going on at all. It was peaceful in Tripoli. That, they were talking about Tripoli.
And this is information from people who are actually in Tripoli?
Yes, and that's to. Different channels like BBC, Al Arabiya, like other English channels who really transformed the correct and the right correction.
If there isn't actually anything going on in Tripoli, as has been insinuated and discussed in the media, do you think Gaddafi is actually really threatened then?
There is something going on in Tripoli, but people are not hit by air flights, for example, by a fleet of armies, you know, from the air to the ground. Mm. This is not true. At the same time, people were not encouraged to gather. They right. did not want them to be in groups moving from one area to another area. Whenever there is a group of Libyan citizens together,
yeah.
the army or the police just fired, yes, to spread that group from each other.
Okay. How spontaneous is the uprising, do you think?
It went quite quickly. It was, you know, very small group of people who have friends of them in prison, and that prisoner was not even seen by the court. And they demanded that prisoner should be released before he goes to the court. Right. This is the situation.
Okay.
But from there, it just expanded incredibly.
So there may be a civil war now, but what is likely to be the best outcome for the people of Libya?
I think there has been two statements, one from the son of Gaddafi 2 days ago, and the other one from Gaddafi himself today. They clearly stated that they will be listening to people. They would like to listen to them and negotiate with them. They would like to implement all their requirements, and they will deliver it. The only, you know, thing that I don't really like is that we are losing a lot of blood and a lot of casualties.
Mm.
This is not what we want. We want a compromised situation, our solution to help those people get out of this misery and use their daily life and forget about all the personal benefits. Let's think about the community benefit. Let's think about what is the best for the Libyan and what's the best for the Libya itself.
Okay, from your own personal experiences, just to finish, if people want to know what's really going on in Libya, what do you suggest they do if the news are telling us things that are not true?
I think I cannot confirm, I cannot recommend any method of communication apart from direct communication with people in Libya.
Okay. Mohammed Al-Tahad, thank you very much for coming in, and we hope all the best for your family that are living out in Libya.
Thank you.
Well, you may not realise it, but the Roman Empire had a financial crisis 2,000 years ago. Topical news here, definitely. But the question is, what can we learn from their experience? Writer and filmmaker Bill Still looks at the issue in his recent film, The Secret of Oz.
So let's take a journey down the yellow brick road through monetary history. Our first stop will be Rome. The problem with money is that, like many other things in life, people fight over who gets to be in control of it. In fact, the only time Jesus became violent was when he chased the money changers from the temple. He made a whip out of cords, and he scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. What was that all about? The money changers were the bankers of that day. They had created a special silver coin called the half shekel of the sanctuary. Even the poor had to have some of these coins to pay their temple tax, so the money changers could charge whatever the market would bear. This monopoly on money was nothing less than stealing from the poorest Jews on their holiest ground. This outraged Jesus just as it would outrage the senators of the Roman Republic a few years later. Although we will never know for sure, fighting over control of money may have been the cause of one of the most famous assassinations in history. What made Rome great? There were many factors, but certainly the most overlooked was the money system of the Roman Republic. About 300 BC, the Roman Republic supplied the people with a plentiful form of cheap money, money made from copper and bronze. Then they spent this cheap money into the economy. It was a revolutionary idea. Today, opponents of this money system call it fiat money, money not backed by precious metals. But what the Roman Republicans had discovered was that it doesn't matter what backs the money. All that matters is who controls its quantity. Did it work back then? It was amazingly effective. Unlike today, it was a money system created without debt to the government. This was the first great experiment in wresting the money power from the goldsmiths. This cheap form of money circulated for the benefit of all citizens equally, not just the usual gold coins, which always benefit the rich. With this new, plentiful supply of money, real wealth flowed to the common man.
Without the use of either gold or silver, Rome became mistress of commerce of the world. Her people were the bravest, the most prosperous, the most happy, for they knew no grinding poverty. Her money was issued directly to the people, and was composed of a cheap material, copper and brass, based alone upon the faith and credit of the nation. With this abundant money supply, she built her magnificent courts and temples. She distributed her lands among the people in small holdings, and wealth poured into the coffers of Rome.
That was Bill Still, looking at lessons we can learn from the financial crisis in Rome 2,000 years ago, in his film The Secret of Oz.
Now we have some music, and this is Motorhead with Get Back in Line.
Do it!
always a pleasure to introduce the Bard of Wimble Hill, Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hello there, John.
How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm very well indeed, yes.
You look better. You're looking fine, fettle. You were a little poorly, I think, the last time I saw you.
Yes, a little bit. There's a sort of threat of some imminent unpleasantness, which...
Are you aware, out of curiosity, of the legacy of a poet I was reading, the worst poet in the English language I'm informed, William McGonagall?
I know of him, yes.
I recommend his poetry. I found that very funny.
Yes.
It was very amusing. But anyway, what do you have today? Markedly better than his, no doubt.
Well, we live in interesting times.
Right.
And this is, it's the topic of the moment, Arabian eruption. The Arab world is erupting with a freedom song that has waited and waited and waited so long that it senses its time will not wait any longer as the fire catches hold and the flames grow stronger. For the longer and longer that you hold down a lid, the bigger the eruption when they know what was hid by the secret of forces who held it all together, believing that their systems could go on forever. While they kept their fat fists on the levers of power, forgetting that the beast they hold down may devour their networks of terror when the tables are turned and the temples of their torture are ransacked and burned. There's a mighty wind blowing and it's gathering speed, and it's big and it's angry, and it knows that it needs to carry off the old man whose exit's overdue, as the will of the many swamps the force of the few. And they know of 89 and the fall of the wall, so they know they can do it if they do it one and all. The oppressed, the hunted, and the long ground down are taking to the streets of every Arabian town. As all across the Arab world, from Libya to Bahrain, the genie's out of the bottle and won't go back again, and they feel they can win as they've seen it before when history's forces knock upon history's door. So the thing can't end till it's done what it must. It's blowing in from the desert and it's fueled by trust that it knows where it's going, and it is not wrong, for the Arab world is erupting with a freedom song.
There's a lot of positivity and enthusiasm in that. I like that. Let's hope that events match up to that in due course.
Yes.
The Bard of Wimble Hill, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And back into his little poetry cupboard he goes. Replete with excellently tasteful cradle-filled T-shirt, Jeff Sparks with the What's On This Week.
Thank you, John. This is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 4th of March, the Get Outs will be performing with support from Audio Beaver and also the Mutations at the Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £2 in advance. On Saturday, 5th of March, the 1960s tribute band The Mods will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Seth Lakeman. This musician will be performing on Friday, 29th of April, as one of the headliners at the Bristol Folk Festival, which will be held at the Colston Hall. The album is titled Poor Man's Heaven, and the song is titled The Hurlers.
Sunday morning in the summertime, over worship we hurl us climb, over mountains, valleys deep, those bells were ringing. All good hurlers at the devil's feast, and he will curse you the way you stand. Mark his circle upon our land. Oh, the boys, come on, make your choice. And he said, oh, you hurler boys, come on, make your choice the way you stand. Rising, and we were trapped. Oh, the boys. hand. Voices cried out, bloody silver, our hearts of stone. We make no shadows, we stand alone.
Go, little boys, well, come on, make your choice.
And he said, oh, you heard the boys, come on, make your choice. He said, oh, you heard the boys, well, come on, make your choice.
Seth Lakeman with The Hurlers from the album Poor Man's Heaven, which was released in 2008. For more information on the Bristol Folk Festival, check out www.bristolfolkfestival.com. On to Sunday, 6th of March, South Pole Fakers, The Action Plan, Jack Bird, Livewire, and many more bands will all be performing at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol, as part of Punk in Drublic, a celebration of some of the Southwest's best punk acts. Doors open at 4 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on 6th of March, Peter Frampton will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £24 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Peter Frampton. Frampton's alive! Whenever I hear the name Seth Lakeman, I always remember the guy named Seth from Emmerdale who had the massive sideburns. Yes! That's the end of this week's Dialect Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Dialect reporter Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Alec Milne. The studio guest was Mohammed El Haddad, and the poetry was by Trevor Carter, and the What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks. And The World This Week, of course, not forgetting, was by Julian Parry, who had an uncle who looked like a Smurf.
Johnny Royden was the studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks. So it's goodbye from us all here at Dialect, and see you next week. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Goodbye.
Weapons are pretty well understood, but when it comes to atomic explosions, the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Meet Tess Abel.
A submarine bomb exploded in a harbor might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site. But might be entered briefly, or passed through quickly, with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. They're beamed right at one's self-esteem. A Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you'd insist, would be symptomatic. A toupee. And the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back. Same color.
Soldier, you look a little bit worried. Well, I am, Chaplain. Just a little bit. Actually, there's no need to be worried, as the Army has taken all of the necessary precautions to see that we're perfectly safe here. Sir, have you ever been out of one of these shops before? Yes, I've had the opportunity to see a number of the atomic tests. I feel that as a chaplain, it is my responsibility to be with my men. What's it like, Chaplain? First of all, one sees a very, very bright light, followed by a shock wave, and then you hear the sound of the blast, and then it seems as though there's a minor earthquake. And then you look up and you see the fireball as it ascends up into the heaven. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
Thank you.
the guessing game starts. All right, let's take a few minutes right now and get acquainted with an A-bomb. Meet Test Able. A submarine bomb exploded in a cannon might affect a city. The affected area would be a poor picnic site, but might be entered briefly or passed through quickly with a varying degree of risk. Some of the falsehoods circulated about radiation effects are trivial, but upsetting. They're beamed right at one's self-esteem. Enough exposure to radiation will cause loss of hair. The treatment, if you insist, would be symptomatic, a toupee. But the condition would only be temporary. Your hair would come back, same color, same power.
Much about the atom bomb if it were to kill you right out. What scares me is that awful gas that deforms you.
Yeah. That would be bad.
Yeah.